Hi, I'm Madhvi Romani.
And I'm Rina Grobe.
And this is Misinformed, the podcast that keeps you aware of feminist news and culture the easy way.
So, Madhvi, what are we talking about today?
Today, we are joined by Susan Stone and Katie Derbyshire of the amazing Dead Ladies Show. If you haven't heard of it, the Dead Ladies Show is a Berlin-based live show, as well as a podcast, that celebrates the fabulous lives of women who are dead. Covering all walks of life, from ancient mathematicians to silent movie stars to record-breaking athletes, the Dead Ladies Show is all about women and non-binary people who have achieved great things against all odds. So Rina and I have been fans for a while, and last week we were on the show presenting India's bandit queen, Phoolan Devi, who had a crazy life. And we had such a great time that we thought we would return the favour and ask you to come onto our podcast.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. What you're doing is such a feminist project, and I wanted to know how you conceived of the idea. Did it come about as a sort of feminist rage, or
The non-present member of the team is Florian Dysons, who is an old friend of mine from Berlin, and he and I were having a drink together and telling each other about dead ladies, two in particular.
Which two?
It was Irmgard Koyne, who was a German writer mostly in the 30s, and
the amazing Dorothy Parker.
Thank you. Yes, I was just forgetting her name. And then we just said, oh, you know, I didn't know Dorothy Parker very well. Florian didn't know Irmgard at all, I think. And it was really interesting to just tell each other this stuff. And I think we read some of their work. We were just sitting on the sofa and having a nice evening. And we joked, like, oh, well, we should make this into a show with an audience. And then we just did. We tried it out and it worked. You were there the first time, right?
I was there the first time, the second time.
And we've made little adjustments along the way, but we mostly stuck to the same formula. And now there's a podcast, thanks to Susan.
Yeah, I just started taping at some point. I have a radio background. I had the equipment, and I think I presented at the third show. And, I was there on almost every show, and I thought at some point, this would make a great podcast. Mm-hmm. So I just started recording. You know, I just plugged in and started recording and thought, well, hopefully we can do something with this someday. And the someday only took about a year or so to materialize, which was great. And we were able to start our podcast as well. So
I love hearing about that evolution, because it does have a little bit of a bar-y feel. Normally, yeah. It's a could.
It's a night out.
It's a night out. So it has that feel. And then it's also in German and English, which reflects your kind of background. You're a translator. And then, Susan, you translated it from a show, you know, a live show into a podcast.
Very good.
And then it also got translated recently into a different setting, New York. You have a New York edition.
And Belgium.
So it's becoming like
a global power.
Yes.
It's like a benevolent power.
A common good.
Yes, a global common good.
Yeah. And what are the differences between New York and Belgium and Berlin?
So the Belgians do it in a language that I do not understand.
The Florian does.
Florian comes from Netherlands and speaks Flemish as well. So the Belgians do one show and they take it to...
They take it on the road. Different... It's almost more like a traveling show. Yeah. So they develop it. And I believe there's always music
exactly.
as well. And they have quite notable authors. And we have had our share of notable authors as well on the stage. I'm sure we will. In the future, too. But they kind of encapsulate it. They sort of brand it, sell it a little bit differently. And I've never seen one. I mean, I don't speak Flemish. I speak a little bit of Nederlands, but I would love to check it out.
Yeah. Oh, they don't do it in Flemish and English. They just
just
Flemish. Yeah.
Whereas in New York, it's all in English.
It's all in English, right?
Although I think people do ask. You could speak in German. No.
They do it every month. I think sometimes their talks are a bit shorter. What I notice is possibly, I almost think it's like a little bit of a generational, or maybe it's just however people approach research, it's a little bit different. You get a lot more Wikipedia references from the lovely New Yorkers. And they have a really interesting range. I think I always find it fun to find out who that, who they're doing. And they do a lot of people from New York. I mean, New York has a lot of great historical figures or little known figures from all walks of life. But yeah, I would say it's just almost just a slightly different spice.
I love that it's so localized like that.
Because you hear that, I think also, for instance, in the show that you and Arena were at, Katie did a talk and she was talking about Therese Giese, who was a German actor. And you threw in a little bit of, you know, down the road is this theater or in Berlin this. You know, we do have references when we have well, Josephine Baker also had a time in Berlin. There are a lot of notable women who spent some time in Berlin and we do try to weave that in. But then I have to kind of decide, okay, how much of this is too local? I mean, the same thing with some of the New York stuff. Is this too local? Will it play in, you know, the Philippines? Will our listeners in South Korea understand how much needs to be explained? So luckily we do have this amazing global audience, but that does impact a little bit. We don't want it to impact how people do their presentations, but it does impact how I might make some decisions about editing in the end.
And so I'm going to ask this question to both of you, but I'll start with Katie because you sometimes do this in German. And like Susan pointed out, you present women who have some sort of relationship to Berlin sometimes. And I was wondering in general, like, what kind of women, dead women, are you drawn to? And who is your favorite dead woman that you've presented so far?
I think I'm drawn to women who do things differently, be that kind of revolutionaries quite often. I do like a nice revolutionary. Or women who, you know, find a crooked path to where they want to go. And I think my favourite has got to be Laverne Baker, who was a singer in, I think she was from Chicago. And she was an R&B singer. And then was sort of fairly successful and was covered, but had songs that she originally did were covered by Elvis, as familiar pattern. But then she disappeared and nobody knew where she was. And she was, it turned out she was, I think, speaking of the Philippines.
She was in the Philippines.
She was in the Philippines, right?
A military
base. Exactly. She was working on this military base and running this like social club on the US Army base in somewhere in the Philippines and was kind of rediscovered. Somebody went out looking for her and kind of did some detective work and found her, brought her back to New York in the end, and she finished her life. She ended her life kind of performing. Although she lost two legs to diabetes, she was still on stage and doing what she loved.
Wild.
Yes.
Love it. And who is your favorite dead lady?
I think I often try to look, because I'm American, sometimes I try to look at American history and see who hasn't been talked about enough and who, especially for maybe Europeans, like maybe we know or should know some of these women in the United States. But I feel like even if they're really well known, you know, in the States, I feel like they need a broader platform and I want people to know about them and know about, I feel like these talks often highlight maybe lesser known incidents in American history that's really awful. I mean, there are plenty, but that maybe, again, Europeans or people around the world don't know about. For example, I talked about Ruth Asawa, who was a Japanese-American artist, really amazing, beautiful sculptural works, similar to basket weaving, but in wire, kind of creating these really floating shapes that are transcendent. She does have a following. She also did public sculpture in California, and her works were in the last Venice Biennale as part of a special exhibition. So she hasn't been completely forgotten by art people, but I feel like more people need to know her story. And part of that was her time as a child and a teenager in an internment camp. And there was a period during the Second World War in the US where Japanese American citizens were rounded up and put in internment camps for several years. I mean, Ruth, you know, she was, I don't know, maybe 10 or so when she went. She went to school there. She was on the yearbook committee there. She learned how to do art there, etc. You know, people, they had their whole lives in these camps. And it's really unbelievable when you look into it. And what I find so fascinating about her, she came from a farming family, and if she hadn't gone into the camp, and this is her idea about it, she wouldn't have become an artist. So she was never bitter about this terrible thing that had happened to her, but she accepted it and she built upon it, and it really gave her her path to becoming this world-renowned artist, which I just find so amazing.
Yeah, wow. And it's really inspiring. Like, I find, because we did Fuglendevi, and then it kind of made us reflect on our own lives, first of all, how good our own lives are,
for sure.
And also just, like, resilience, and it shed light on a lot of other women's lives and stuff like that. What are some of the takeaways in general about what, you know, that you get from women's lives, or is it like individual to each life?
It is. I mean, every life is different, and sometimes I'm kind of reluctant to make it into a like a life improving lesson.
Yes,
you know,
yes,
sometimes
yes.
It's just enough to see, okay, this woman has did this amazing stuff, and we've forgotten about her. But then sometimes they, particularly the revolutionaries, as I say, are like, oh yes, let's remember to stand up for our rights and that kind of thing. So that's, I suppose, what I often get out of it.
And I think, and I've said this before, that these women don't have to be role models. They don't have to be inspirational.
Yeah.
I mean, Fuglendevi, she is inspirational, but she also did a lot of bad stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I understand why. But, you know, so, you know, no judgment. But, you know, so we don't, you know, we say, you know, of course, the three rules, which we haven't talked about yet.
No, there are three rules that each dead lady has to meet in order to be on the show.
Yes, they have to be a woman or have identified as a woman while they were alive.
And, or non-binary.
Or non-binary. And they have to be dead. That's in the title.
Right. And the third was most important.
No fascists.
Yeah.
No fascists. Where did the no fascist rule come from?
You think you shouldn't have to have a rule that says that, right?
Right. You should, would think that. But because we're in Berlin, people kept coming to us and saying, can I talk about...
Leni Riefenstahl.
And we're like, no. There's enough women who are Nazis.
If people don't know who she is, I don't know if we should tell them or not. She was a filmmaker and she was a Nazi. So, I mean, it's the same with Coco Chanel. You know, people would love to do Coco Chanel, some people, and we're not that interested.
Yeah. It's also to do with being in Berlin, and that the history of the country is that there were women who were Nazis, you know, and they do exercise a certain fascination for some people. And there's a lot of pilots. Obviously, the way to become a pilot was to work for the Nazis. So, you know, which is a decision that these women made, and we don't want to have them on our show. Thank you very much.
That's it.
But going back to when I say they don't have to be role models, they can't be fascists.
Right. That's the exception. They don't have to be a role model.
Yeah, they don't have to be a role model, but they can't have been fascists.
I feel like this is, this is a rule that came about because we're in Berlin, right? Like, it wouldn't really occur otherwise.
But the other shows stick to it too.
Yes.
Very sweet of them.
And really unfortunately, there are fascists everywhere.
Yeah,
so.
Oh, yeah, there
are. You can't be too careful.
The other question I wanted to ask you was about research, actually, because some of these ladies... you know, it's a process of taking them out of the archive or finding them or whatever. I remember seeing a film about Fuglendevi a long time ago and just being, this is wild. And then when I was researching, I realized that the film was made by men, and and she wasn't very happy about it, and she never even got invited to see it, and they capitalized on her life, and I was like, oh, that's problematic. Then we read her autobiography, and then different sources. How do you find these women in the first place? And then what's a really good way of trying to gather all the information needed in order to present their lives in a ridiculous 20 to 30 minute slot, I have to say.
Autobiography is always great, but it's not enough. And of course, not all women have written an autobiography. I think we've all become a little bit skeptical about reading autobiographies with a pinch of salt, right?
Yeah.
And then we just scrabble around for whatever we can find.
Yeah, I think I would say in my experience, there haven't been too many people who haven't had something written about them. Interestingly, I did a presentation about the architect Zaha Hadid. And of course, there's been a lot written about her, but there was no autobiography, there was no biography. So it was calling together different kinds of things to be able to capture not just her amazing talent and her abilities and business sense and et cetera, but also her crazy personal life, which, you know, a lot of these things, it was like you were talking about Teresa Giza, and she didn't like to have aspects of her life publicized. I mean, she kept her cards pretty close to her chest, as they say. And I think that's the case with a lot of women. And sometimes you have to ask yourself, if this person has written a lot about themselves, Hildegard Knif, is it factual?
Yeah.
Is the purpose of it to paint her in a specific light and rewrite some history?
But I think just consciously reading, because as you said, you know, there are biographies that have their own agenda, especially about historical women, depending on when they were written and by whom and for what purpose, you know? I think just thinking, okay, how do I read this?
And if you can get something in the person's voice, then of course that's
stupendous,
even if it's just a quote, you know, even if it's not a recording. I mean, a recording would be amazing. Like you did have a recording of Constance Markowitz. It was revolutionary, very crackly, but worth it.
And also what I really liked about your presentation, Teresa Giza, was that there was actual clips of her playing music and singing and acting and all of that stuff.
Yeah, it's always very rich when you were looking at actors,
Yeah, I love that. And that's why it's really worth, like, going to the live show too, because you can really, like, get that visual.
Visuals, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
It's really great. All those pictures and...
Yeah, well, the show came first and then the podcast, which is why there's pictures. We just try and explain what's happening on the screen.
Yeah, no, I like that though, because I think the people who listen probably... will get a little bit of that sort of sensual information.
And we do very thorough episode notes with pictures and clips and things like that, that, you know, within copyright, that are available on our website that for each episode. So if people do feel like they're missing or they on something or they want to see an image or a picture, especially if we do an artist, we'll say you can go now to the website, start looking, and then start listening. Yeah.
Or just go and look at Constance Markiewicz's hat.
Yes, it's a big hat.
That's cool. And then you get like we did, we were guests on to present a woman that we had chosen. So you have a lot of special guests who, apart from us, of course, has been, well, I don't want you to pick favorites, but... Because then you don't really know what's coming, right? Because you haven't chosen those.
No, we don't edit their talks. Yeah. We give them guidelines, but we set them loose.
So I just wanted to know, like, what talk that, you know, you've enjoyed has been most surprising to you, either in the way that it's been presented or, you know, the choice of person.
Do you know what? I have forgotten the name of the woman, but we do have one about this athlete that you mentioned, actually.
Oh, Fanny Blinkers-Kuhn.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yes. And I really...
Episode 2.
I am allergic to sports.
Me too.
Right? And I was like, oh my God, it's going to be about sports. But it was not dull. So that was a surprise.
And it wasn't about sports, really. I mean, it sort of was, but it was about her.
Yeah.
And the challenges that she had to participate in sports as a woman.
Check out episode 2. I haven't listened to episode 2, but now I'm inspired to do so. What about you, Susan?
I'm going to say, and it wasn't a surprise that it was excellent, of course, but the talk from Sharon Dadua O'Toole, which was on Nanaya Asantewa, who was a, I would say, I don't know if it's exactly the right geographical aspect, but West African queen and ruler, and she was a very fierce leader, very impressive woman, lived quite a long time, and really fought the English colonizers. And she was such a impressive figure. It's hard. I just keep saying impressive because that's, I just almost see her as, and she did show a picture of her as a statue. That's what sort of, I imagine this woman being 10 feet tall. You know, that's the kind of power that she had in a world of men. I don't know the number of that episode, but that's, I'm going to say it's probably around 40 something, but do check that one out as well. And that's just, it's an area that I don't know that much about. Mm. And that is one thing that is a pleasure to have somebody talking about someone I've never heard of from an area I know very little about or from a time period I know nothing about, like an ancient mathematician, for example. I mean, I'd certainly heard the name Hypatia, but I didn't know very much about her. And I learned so much from our amazing presenter, Karen Margolis, who is a mathematician herself. I mean, what kind of amazing context can you wish for other than that? So, and that's episode 1.
Amazing. What a brilliant project. How much fun, first of all. And also, what a brilliant project to make these women's lives and stories heard. Our episode on Fool and Dovey is out now. You can listen to that at the Dead Lady Show. And here's a little teaser for you if you're curious about who the hell she was.
We're super excited to talk about this dead lady. Her name is Phoolan Devi, otherwise known as India's Bandit Queen.
So before we start, this episode is going to be a little bit fool on.
Oh, people laughed.
Thanks, guys. Thank you so much. Because she had a pretty, pretty wild life. So we're just going to start with a couple of trigger warnings. So in this episode, we will talk about violence, assault, child abuse, rape, kidnapping, sexual violence, and murder. So feel free to step out, switch off if you need to. At any point, if it gets too much, please feel free to leave. And with that, I hand over the mic to Madhuri.
Thank you. We might curse a bit too.
Oh, yes.
I think that's everything. So the reason we chose this amazing woman is, yes, she was very special, but what she went through is kind of representative of what a lot of women in the world are going through even today. But those women's stories are kind of undocumented. Those voices are unheard. But with Phoolan Devi, we have her autobiography, which is really special because, like a lot of women who come from Uttar Pradesh in North India, she was illiterate. Even at the moment, I think the illiteracy rate in Uttar Pradesh, which is super poor, is at 63%. No, the literacy rate for women is at 63%. So it's a lot of women who can't read and write. But the reason that we have this amazing autobiography is because a publisher came to her in 1994, after she was released from about 11 years in jail. Before that, she was playing this cat and mouse game with the police for about 3.5 years. She had a price of $10,000 on her head. The Prime Minister of India, Indira Gandhi, knew who she was, and she was wanted for 48 counts of murder. No, 48 counts of major crime, 22 murders only. Sorry. It's all the same after you get to a certain point. I'm not talking from experience.
Yes.
Lootings, kidnappings, and just generally being a bandit. And she had captured the imagination of a nation. She was known as the female Robin Hood and was really praised and welcomed by thousands. One of our friends that we spoke to, who should be here now, but he's Indian, so he's kind of unreliable, I guess.
No, he's here.
Oh, he's here. I didn't see him. I'm sorry. Let's edit that out.
He's here and he's reliable.
He's here. He's reliable, like all Indian people. He said that when he was growing up in India as a child, if he didn't behave, his mother would tell him that Phoolan Devi would come and get him. So how did this woman, who was shorter than me, which is about, I'm over 5 foot, but she was under 5 foot, she was illiterate, she was very slight, she came from an absolute impoverished background, how did she become a kind of larger than life figure? And I think it starts really in her childhood. She was born in 1963 in a village near the Yamuna River.
I'm forgetting my duties, I'm sorry.
That's okay, you had one job, Rina. Her family was poor. She had one dress and no shoes. In fact, no one in her family had any shoes. And much of her childhood is characterized by hunger. There's just never enough to eat. She remembers eating handfuls of mud from the riverbanks as a child. And in the next slide,
I remembered.
We see that one of her chores was making dung cakes, which she used to do with her mother. So her mother used to squat down in front of the dung pat and knead these cakes. And then they would take these cakes, the girls, and put them up in piles to dry, and then they would carry them on their heads from the field back to the village. This is actually a practice that's still done today because dung cakes are used to burn as fuel, to keep people warm in the winter, and as cooking fuel also, and then also to fertilize the crops. So when she wasn't doing this or working in the field or collecting the water or doing her chores in the house as a child, she had to do any chores that any of the other villagers asked her for so that she could maybe get something to eat. And one of her earliest memories is when the Pradhan, who is this village head, asks her to massage his head. So she's a child and she's doing this, and in front of her in the courtyard is this big pile of mangoes from his tree. And she's never seen mangoes so amazing before because they're poor, they only get the shittiest mangoes, and she's hungry, she's a child, the smell of these mangoes sort of overcome her, and she asks him, hey, can I have maybe a little piece of mango? His response to this is to slap her so hard that it resonates in her head. She's dizzy, she falls over, she's really scared, she wets herself, and she manages to run back to her mother. She tells her mother what happened, and she's pretty sure she's going to get beaten by her mother too, because she gets beaten by everyone all the time. In fact, one of her games that she plays with her sister is to kind of compare the bruises and marks on their bodies. But her mother doesn't beat her. Her mother has a kind of different response. Her mother is really fiery and really angry, so she drags her by the hand back to the house of the Pradhan, and she shouts at him. She says, "You think we bring children into this world to be your slaves. Why don't you just kill her instead of hitting her? Because then she wouldn't ask for your mangoes. Here, kill her if you like." So her mother's a little bit extreme. And it's a very different response from what she gets from her father, who is really ashamed about this entire incident, because he says it's their duty to serve other people in the village who are of a higher caste. Now, when it comes to caste in India, this is kind of a common belief, because in Hinduism you're born into a certain caste, and there are four main castes and one non-caste, which is the Dalits, which are, if you've read Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Children, she's talking about them then. And it's believed that if you're born into this caste, it's based on your previous lives and your deeds in your previous lives. So your position in society is kind of part of a divine order, really. So it's determined by God. And even if you treat people of a lower caste kind of badly, you're sort of enacting their karma, so it's all good. There's this idea that you should just like live with your lot in life. And Fulan is from a lower caste. She's from specifically a subcaste called the Mullahs, who are fishermen and boatmen. So her father tells her to just, you know, submit to it, and she has to do her duty. But Fulan is already a fighter. She just can't in her mind come to terms with this. One day she takes a lathi or a stick and she plans to go to the ravines, which is like in the Chambal Valley, this big sort of vast no man's land, to find God, because she's kind of convinced that that's where God lives. And she wants to ask him a lot of questions. She wants to ask him, this God who made her born here in this caste, in this village, you know, how can people like the Pradhan treat her badly? How is it possible that her father's brother cheated them out of the land that was rightfully theirs, which means that they are especially destitute? So she sees all this injustice, and she actually starts to wage a war on her uncle and her older cousin brother, who's called Mayadin. And at the age of 10, she starts like picking nuts from their fields and eating them. And she gets caught, and she's beaten, and she's dragged in front of the village elders, and she waits there by herself as a 10-year-old child, you know, just seeing what these old men are going to decide is her punishment. But surprisingly for her, she actually wins. They say that since the land is in dispute and it's kind of family land, she can eat all the nuts she wants from this land. And so it's her first victory. To be fair, she doesn't have many victories. she's trying to like save this neem tree once with her body, and she gets beaten with a brick. None of the villagers help her, all of this kind of stuff. So it's very bad. But she is a bit of a troublemaker by this age. And by the age of 11, because she is kind of making waves a bit, her cousin conspires to arrange a marriage for her at the age of 11 to a man who is 3 times her age. So he's like 45. And in India, this might again sound a bit weird, but UNICEF says that 27% of girls in India today are married before the age of 18. And in the 70s, when this happened to Phoolan Devi, when she was married, the figure was at more than 50%. And normally what happens is when you get married at the age of 11, you stay at your parents' house until you're kind of age to go to your in-laws' house. And that's what was agreed. But this guy, who's a total bastard, broke this agreement and decided to just that he wanted to take her, and they couldn't really do anything about it because it's tradition. So she's taken to this house of a 45-year-old man. He rapes her, beats her, tortures her. It's terrible. At the age of 12, she manages to run away, and she crosses a vast expanse of arid land on foot to get back to her village. When she gets back to her village, she's kind of not welcomed because it's not what is expected. Like, it's a big shame to leave your husband. So she's sent back eventually because she's a shamed woman. And then again, when she goes back, her husband has married a new woman, a new wife, and both of them torture her almost to death. The only reason she's able to survive this is that word gets back to her village. Her father goes and begs for her to be taken to the hospital, and then they bring her back to the village. For the next few years, her life is terrible because now she is a spoiled woman. It's her fault, basically. All the blame is on her. And she's not protected by her husband. And she is repeatedly abused and raped by all of the people of higher castes around her. Her strife with her cousin continues. He says at one point he accuses her of theft. We don't know whether this is true or not, but she is taken into police custody. And again, she's held there for about 3 weeks. She's beaten. She's raped by all the police. And so, yeah, I know what you're thinking. She's still a teenager. She's been subjected by all this unspeakable violence, but it's also not unusual. According to one recent poll, 23% of low-caste women said that they were raped in what is caste rape. And this is vastly underreported because, like I said, if you go to the police, you're likely to face kind of assault again. Phoolan Devi, in her own words, told one reporter, "Do you have any idea what it's like to live in a village in India? What you call rape, that kind of thing, happens to poor women in villages every day. It's assumed that the daughters of the poor are for the use of the rich. They assume that we are their property." So that's her life that she's condemned to and that she's still fighting for somehow in her village until one rainy night, a group of police officers surround her house.
Da, da, da. To listen to the rest of Phoolan's story, I promise it gets even better. Tune in to the latest episode of The Dead Lady Show wherever you get your podcasts.
There you go.
And Rena, thank you so much for coming on our show.
And thank you, Katie and Susan, for coming on our show. This is amazing. We would love to do it again. We didn't realise how hard it was to fit everything into 30 minutes. And
you got 30 minutes.
Exactly.
And usually it's shorter.
Exactly. Yeah. And at some point we were like, oh, we're going over time because we did practice it. And then we were like, yeah, but if Phoolan taught us anything by her life, it was like, don't just accept what you're given. We were given a measly 30 minutes. Will we take it? We got it down, I think, to time.
Well, that's what editing is for.
And I look forward to seeing you at the next Dead Lady Show.
Thank you so much.
Likewise.
Thank you.
For all links to sources and further reading for this week's episode, subscribe to our newsletter, misinformed.substack.com.
Email us if you'd like to come on the show or join our book club, misinformed.podcast@gmail.com.
Follow us on Instagram @the_miss_informed.
And support the show via Patreon by going to patreon.com/misinformed.